Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I am doing okay.
And in the current state of the world, sometimes that's all we can ask for. Today is going to be a spoilerific episode. We know that you guys do love that. But it is something that I believe Matt and I have both got to the end or completion of the Ardenweald campaign storyline, which if you've been keeping up on your renown with your Chosen Covenant, you should have been getting to the conclusion of your Covenant storyline right about the past week or, you know, this weekend.
And I've also seen the end of the Kyrian one as well.
I have not caught that one yet, but you can absolutely feel free to talk about that in that campaign. But I figured we'd go through a little bit about the Ardenweald campaign, how that storyline sort of unfolds, and get to the end of it and kind of give our thoughts on it. So let's talk about how it opens up. So the very first thing it does is it's the welcome to Ardenweald stuff, right? It's the, hey, you're here. Tell us your story. What's going on? It does the whole theater thing after you choose your covenant where you explain all of your life story, all the adventures and misadventures you've had up to that point. And then, you know, basically you're free to join the Wild Hunt and do everything that you need to do to sort of bring balance to the land. I liked the opening of this sort of covenant a lot more than I think some of the other ones, at least from the ones that I've experienced. I thought it was unique. I thought it was interesting. I liked the interaction with the sort of the crowd and how they were reacting. Like, wait, he killed a whole planet? Why is there a giant sword sticking out of it? Why does that work? Like, there's a lot of comedy and a lot of not taking itself seriously while also still conveying the seriousness of everything we've...
There's one thing in that bit that I'm positive is a reference to Avatar The Last Airbender.
Okay.
There's a part where as you're done with everything, you're doing your play bit to introduce yourself. You go backstage and the guy goes, whoa, you just went from one war to the other like that? That's rough, friend. And I'm convinced that's a reference to Zuko from Avatar going, after Sokka tells him that his girlfriend became the moon ghost, that's rough, buddy. that's what I'm convinced that was a reference to that.
Yeah, I would not be surprised. But yeah, so that's sort of the introductory to it. And after that, you are sent to go aid. I believe it's Tir na vol first, isn't it?
Honestly, not sure. I mean, when you do the zone or when you're doing the campaign?
The campaign.
Honestly, I mostly remember, like, you go out and you're like basically trying to figure out what's going on with the Drust. And then you get sidetracked with Bon Sunmi. And that's kind of like, there's kind of like three tiers to the campaign. Mm-hmm. There's what are the Drust doing? There's what happened to the Night Elves that died at Teldrassil? Because when you're doing the initial opening thing, when you do, they're like, hey, wait a minute. If that happened, where are all these people?
Yeah, because that was definitely something they key on, right? Like they're like, wait, that's a whole lot of souls. That's a whole population of people. Where did they go? So yeah,
Finally, like you've got the Drust, the Night Elves in Taronda, and the Bwon Samedi stuff. And it's kind of like those three things are kind of the big deal of the campaign.
Yeah, so I guess we can go through. I think we can probably start with the Taran stuff, as I think, and the Ysera Taran Night Elf stuff, and talk about how that sort of unfolded. So part of the whole thing with Ardenweald is you save a wild seed, and it's a special wild seed, and you petition the queen to wake her up, and that's when the big reveal that it's Ysera. And if you missed all the hints leading up to that point, but it shouldn't be that much of a surprise that it is Ysera. Ysera is reborn. Her eyes turn from green to blue as she is now a child of Ardenweald and is sort of signing on to protect Ardenweald, which I always thought was fascinating because the Winter Queen, at one point, when you open up the Queen's Conservatory, you're shown that you can send things back to where they were originally from. And we know that with Ursoc and the Loa and all those other like wild spirits, they can be sent back to Azeroth. So I was always a little curious about why that option wasn't presented to Ysera.
I think it's partially because the way that this went, the queen sacrificed her own personal anima. If you see when she does the thing to bring Ysera back, some of those leaves growing on her head fall off.
But she also does that, or at least
Leaves don't fall off when she does with others. She's not using her own personal anima. This is her anima. It's her. She in order to bring Ysera back, she is binding herself to her. That's the only way she could do it. There wasn't enough anima in the reservoir to res her any other way. Mm. They didn't have another way to save the wild seed. So she gave a part of herself. That's why the leaves fall off. That's the whole symbology of it. It's not a question. There's no option to give Ysera. The Winter Queen preserved her. Otherwise, the wild seed would have withered.
Well, I guess the question then is now later on in the campaign, if that's something that, you know, it never becomes an option, right?
And why would it ever become an option? She's told you this is forever.
Well, because
you're here now. You're bound to this realm. I am this realm, and I have bound you to me. You're bound here. That's it. There's no going back.
The answer that I would, or the counter answer to that, is that you get, at least I got the impression when you talk with, I can't remember the name of the bear spirit that's there.
Elioth?
Yeah. Elioth talks about being bound to the realm, but also talking about how they just can never go home because their home doesn't exist anymore. And it made it feel like that would at some point potentially be an option if they so chose it. Now,
there's nothing in what Elioth says to imply that she's in the same situation as Ysera. There's nothing in anyone. As far as we know, this has never happened before. Okay. Nobody else implies that they've ever had the Winter Queen personally sacrifice. If you watch the cinematic when she does it, jaws hit the floor. The people of Ardenweald are stunned to see this. They've never seen it happen before. They're like, it's a big deal. Not just that it's a big dragon. I mean, they are also kind of like, whoa, it's a big dragon. But, I mean, I definitely get the sense, and keep in mind that this is something that I'm interpreting what I saw. No text where the Winter Queen says, and there's no take backsies, but you definitely get the sense that there's no separating Ysera from where she is now. She's effectively been bound there. And she says something to that effect when she sends you to Alexstrasza, which is also something interesting we should probably talk about at some point, but there's a lot to it because the campaign is so big. There's something like 29 quests in the first part, the For Queen and Country part, which is for Queen Grove, sorry, followed by like the Daughter of the Night Warrior quest chain has got like six. Then there's the boss one, which is the Bwon Samedi bit, which goes, I think, 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
The Night Warrior's Curse one, I think, goes for another 9 or 10. I'm not sure. At this point, I'm guessing. I went and looked some of them up, but I don't have the thing I looked up. But then there's more Drust stuff and more Drust stuff after that. And then there's more of the Loa stuff. And then there's finally the final Drust part. So there's a lot to it. It's a very big campaign. They're all pretty big. Like, looking at the Kyrian one is similarly enormous. Trial of Ascension type stuff. There's a lot to the Kyrian one as well. And in general, I feel like some of the stuff is just we're going to have to accept that they didn't get to telling. They didn't bother to sit down and give you like a point by point explanation of everything that's happening.
And that I mean, I guess the idea is
But here's like to go along with what you were saying. Let's move it to the discussion of what happened to Razan.
Why?
Because I think it's connected. Why did Razan not let I'm just going to flat out tell you guys, Razan is in the Maw when you're there.
There are a series of Loa that have been trapped inside of the Maw, including the Loa of Spiders, who was consumed by her own followers, the Loa of Snakes, who I forgot what they said happened to them, and then Razan, as well as Hyreek. Hyreek is in the Maws, and you are sent to save all of them, to find all of them. And then there's another wild god of, what's his name from Legion, is there?
Hashemon.
Yeah, thank you.
Hashemon wasn't actually like a Loa as such. I think Hashemon was the panther.
They refer to Hashemon as a wild spirit now, like a wild god on that same.
Yeah, level. A wild god, absolutely. Because Hashemon was in the War of the Ancients.
Yep.
I'm just saying it wasn't specifically one of the Loa that was worshipped by the trolls.
Right, but it's all tied into the same quest, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely, it is.
But you are able to free all of them except for Razan. Razan is being worked over by essentially what is a high priest of Moizala, one of his most powerful followers that you have to go and disrupt what they're doing. And as you're doing it, you are the way that is presented is that the anima of Razan is slowly being stripped away from him in a very strange manner, like something that has not been dealt with at all in any other aspect of what we've dealt with so far. And it sort of coincides with what we've been talking about with what happens to souls that go to the Maw and how they're sort of like vivisected and parted out. And that seems to be what's happening to Razan. And don't forget, Razan was one of the most powerful Loa before he died. Powerful enough to tell Bwam Samdi, you know, who was the default Loa of Death at the time, to go fly a kite. And Bwam Samdi listened. He was the Loa of Kings and worshipped by all of the Zandalari forever, in able to keep the kings of the Zandalari lineage alive through the power of him basically just being. So he's being torn apart when we discover him. And you with Vol'jin save him, quote unquote, but even he says he's too far gone to be reconstituted, to be reborn, to be saved, and that if he doesn't do something, he will just essentially cease to exist. Very similar to what happened to Ursoc's anima being sacrificed.
But I think we're missing here, though. What he does do is he puts the last remaining bit of his essence within Vol'jin. But the interesting thing here is that when Vol'jin comes to to Ardenweald, because Bwam Samdi is trying to make a deal with the queen, and he gets shut down hard. By the way, she tells him to f off. She basically just says, "Be good to depart." She's just like, "I will not." Yeah,
I think he gets what he wants out of the deal a little bit, but we can talk about that.
He doesn't get a deal. She straight up tells him no.
I will explain my reasoning when you're done.
Okay, your reasoning is incorrect. Wow, we're having a feisty one this week. But the important thing here is that Vol'jin is now told that even though he is the spirit of a mortal being, now that he's bonded with that essence of Razan, he might get to return to the world of the living in the way you were talking about originally.
Yeah, because now he's part of that Loa, but his spirit was also changed slightly.
Again, here is a situation where somebody is bonded to something else, but he gets to return, or at least the possibility is there.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do that for mortals. Like she specifically says, you don't do that for mortal beings.
Well,
like,
hold on, like her specific verbiage is not that he'll get to return so much as be reborn. He might be able to be reborn anew, which that is a very open-ended statement. We talked about how in Ardenweald things change or choose their form. It's entirely possible that something like that may happen to Vol'jin if that option becomes available to him. To circle back to the Bwam Samdi thing, the reason I think that he might have gotten what he wanted out of the whole deal wasn't necessarily that he wanted to strike a deal. I think he just wanted the Loa to go back into her care and to basically be returned to their cycle, because he doesn't usher them back. She does. That was a lot, like the way it was presented to us in Zandalar by Bwam Samdi was essentially a lie. a lie by omission, but still a lie. And now that he, you know, we went ahead and got these souls, because remember, when he shows up, the Wild Hunt says the Queen has no dealings with you and does not want to deal with you. And he says, I'm not here for the Queen anyway. I'm here for that one. And he points to you, the Mawwalk, and you go and get these Loa, and you are the one that brings them back to the Queen. And yeah, he does this whole thing about, like, I want to strike a deal. And throughout that whole exchange, it ultimately just winds up that she's going to wind up taking care of those souls and make sure that they're returned to the cycle should they be willing or capable. And I think that was his entire goal, because he can't pull those Loa back into our land, the Winter Queen does. So I like I said, I don't think he was actually looking for a deal. My impression is that's what he ultimately... Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but it's the problem is that it's saying he wanted her to do the thing she would have done anyway.
Yeah, but I also think it was... I think with everything that happened with Mwezala up to that point, which, again, part of that campaign is you learn that Mwezala has been stealing wild seeds of Loas, subverting them, trying to bring back his most akin Loa, or use their power to bolster himself, or to bolster
By the way, when you talked before, the serpent Loa in question, Dambala,
yeah,
is not one of the Loa you find in the Maw.
I thought it was.
No, it's Tariq, Razan, and Shadra. That's it.
That's it? Okay. Oh, yeah, Dambala is the one you
fight.
You fight, yeah.
Yeah, you fight and basically kill Dambala. I don't know if that means Dambala is permanently dead, but you fight Dambala and defeat Dambala is part of the whole quest line.
Go ahead. I was going to say, the interesting thing for me is that Hyreek was involved in that, especially with everything that happened in Battle for Azeroth with basically Gahoon and how that all shook out with Hyreek siding with Gahoon. Like, it seemed a little weird to me that during the campaign, one of our tasks was to go and save him. Like, I didn't quite understand that. Like, why? Especially with everything that happened with the Blood Trolls, with everything that happened with the War with the Zandalar. Like, maybe as a Alliance player, it makes more sense, because I don't know if you... As an Alliance player, are you presented with everything that happened with Hyreek or no?
Almost certainly not. I mean, you do see the Hyreek worshippers, but...
Okay, so then my question is, like, as a Horde player who got to see all the horrible things that Hyreek did in service to Gahoon, including turning the Blood Trolls as worshippers of Hyreek into worshippers of Gahoon, why would a Horde player rescue?
Yeah, but from what I understood, Hyreek wasn't in control of what he did. Hyreek was corrupted by Gahoon. So if Gahoon corrupts you, that doesn't mean that your uncorrupted self would be something you don't want to have.
Yeah, maybe. So, I don't know. Maybe I thought it was an interesting thing as far as that goes. But yeah, so go ahead with whatever you were going to say, because I think...
Oh, I have no idea at this point.
But yeah, and
that's why I don't, like, you know, one of the reasons I try to just spit stuff out as fast as possible. If I get interrupted, I forget what I'm saying.
Sorry. But yeah, and I thought it was a fascinating journey through that particular part of the campaign, because I've been curious about a lot of that stuff since Battle for Azeroth, sitting on top of the ziggurat with Boamsamdi, because there was at one point in time, there's that temple outside of the main city, and it has all of the Loa, or had all of the Loa, like statues and altars to all of them, and you got to see images of the ones that were capable of being reborn, including the, I can never remember the Tortolan one, Torga, I think it was?
Yeah, I think Torga, yeah.
Yeah, like, you get to see, like, Torga as a tiny baby, you know, starting its journey back to rebirth. Although we don't encounter Torga in Ardenwell, which I thought was fascinating. But there's just so much cool stuff there to learn, how, like, that Loa are actually ferried back by the Winter Queen, not by Boamsamdi, not by the Loa of Death.
Well, not just the Loa either, for that matter. I mean, the August Celestials are clearly also sent back via the Winter Queen, and there's various other beings. One of the things I thought was interesting, though, that we haven't really talked about yet is, during part of all this, part of the whole basis for the campaign is about the Winter Queen's role in the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And what we see is that the entirety of what the Drust have been up to has been trying to basically seize control of the Grove of Awakening. And they pull it off.
Yeah.
At the end of the campaign, although you stop the one who is, you know, in charge of the thing and destroy her before she can do any more harm, when you get there, the portal is open and some of them are going through it. you see them travel through it. The same portal that you see, you know, the spirits that you regenerate go through when you've used the Queen's Conservatory. It's the same thing. You see some Drust go through it. What does that mean?
And I guess,
are there living Drust now? Are Drust being reborn on Azeroth? How? Are they just like, you know, people being born on Azeroth who have like a Drust inside them? Are the Drust physically returned to Azeroth? How does it work? What does it mean?
Yeah, we still don't know exactly how that goes either, because any of the spirits that we see translate back, especially from the Queen's Conservatory, are still in like that starry spirit form as they go through the portal. So after that point, it's sort of like, I don't know what happens. Do they get shoved back into their mortal shell or whatever the case is? But I thought the Drust portion of this campaign was fascinating for a lot of reasons. One, several of the areas that have fallen under Drust control are actually pretty vast. And it's not just talking about like Tir Nasaith or anything like that. It's just whole swaths of land. I think like one quarter of Ardenwell essentially is just Drust territory. And the number of Night Fae that they have subjugated or corrupted or made to wear the masks, like, you are shown several times the sheer number of just how many folks have fallen to it. Like, and I thought that was really interesting and curious, because I would have expected the Drust part of the campaign to be a larger portion of the campaign in that regard. They're assaulting the different areas, the different Tir Nivals and Hibernal Hollows and places like that. And all of that stuff leads up to that final build up to when you're going to protect the Grove of Awakening or take it back, really. There's just a sea of them, a sea of constructs, a sea of brutes, but most of them are made out of the Fawn, that particular race that exists in Ardenwell.
Silvar?
The Silvar, yeah. It's made up mostly of them in masks, charging towards the Grove or acting as the ground forces of the army. It's not, you know, Drust constructs. It's not, you know, the witches are there in some of the bigger, bulkier general types are there, but most of it is they're using Ardenwell's own forces against it. And I thought that was fascinating, especially given the scope of what was.
Yeah, because it's interestingly, it's an inversion of the magic you saw them using in Battle for Azeroth. It's basically the same kind of thing where you saw them, you know, converting people in Drustvar into their servants, making them the witches and so forth. So it is interesting that they have like the same thing going on in Ardenwell. But when you confront Gorak Zar, and I don't know what relationship Gorak Zar had to Gorak, you know, Gorak Tul or any of the rest of them. But when you confront her, she's already doing it. Like, you know, they've got the portal open. Everyone you talk to, like when you talk to Chandra Featherman, she's like, I do not wish to think what could have happened if the Drust had managed to gain control here. I can see there is still work to be done here in Ardenwell, but at least the threat has been driven back. I'm Alliance, so Taranda, I mean, Chandris and I have a pretty open speech. I know that if you're Horde, she basically just says, I have my misgivings and I will be watching you, she says. She doesn't give you the whole, we have to go find Taranda. She's just like basically like, I don't trust you because you're Horde.
It changes towards the end, at least.
Yeah, well, she still says she doesn't trust you. Like, that's the last thing Chandra says, is I have my misgivings and I will still be watching you, but at least we can agree on helping this place. Is her response if you're Horde. If you're Alliance, she's just like, no, we have to go help Taranda. It's different. I guess I get why that is, but it's interesting. But that whole thing, like the Drust, it doesn't really feel like it's been dealt with to me at all.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's definitely going to be more.
That's what I wanted to talk about, at least as far as like the ending of the campaign goes, because that is the end of the Night Fae Covenant campaign, is going to take back the Grove of Awakening. But I thought it was fascinating because Garak Zar wasn't what I expected to be there waiting. It wasn't what I expected there to be. I expected something more with Garak Tul. I expected something more with his involvement, but he's very light throughout all of this. His name is invoked, but it's not, he doesn't make an appearance. He doesn't make an appearance like he did in Battle for Azeroth. Like, we see him, we interact with him, we shove him back through a portal. Why isn't he here? Where is he? Is he still in Thros? So, yeah, it was just felt almost incomplete. So, yeah, the involvement of Garak Tool is basically non-existent aside from just having his name invoked, which is fascinating. I would have expected him to be way more present, way more involved. Not that the Drust aren't, you know, a thorn in the side of Ardenweald or us as the player, but I would have expected him to pop up in some manner, right?
I mean, I don't know. He might be in the Maw. I mean, that's there. The thing is that I don't understand, to this day, right now, I don't understand the status of the Drust. We know that they're dead, but not dead. They're like kind of like their own constructy version of undead. And it's they're trying to use Ardenweald to get themselves reborn into the circle of, you know, the cycle of life and death and rebirth. And I don't know what happens to a Drust when you kill them in a dungeon. Like, I don't know what happened to Gorok Tool when we killed him. I know that Gorok Zar worked with Gorok Tool, you know, and, you know, was one of the Drust who supported what he was doing. But I don't know what happened to him when we beat him. I don't know where, you know, because he was exiled. He was cast out. He didn't die. Like, all those years ago, he didn't die. He wasn't dead. So I'm not sure what his status was when we killed him.
And I guess we've asked this question before, like, Thros in general, like, is it a plane of existence or a pocket plane that they're tethered to after what they did that sucks them back? Like, we talked about, like, demons and the Twisting Nether and all that stuff over the course of years, and there seems to be some shared DNA there, at least a little bit, with the idea of the Drust. So I don't know if that's something that happens with them, because when we kill him in the dungeon, there's an open portal behind him, and it's an open portal to Thros. Like, it's that inky darkness that you know, we is characterized with all of the Drust stuff, but we don't really have any information regarding that, right?
We know that it's somehow related to druidic stuff. We know that the Drust druids were big on, you know, the balance of life and death, and that's where the Thorn Speakers came from. That's why the Thorn Speakers broke away,
mm-hmm.
because the people like Gorok Tool were exploiting it rather than living within the balance of it. And that's like, there's the whole, you know, the whole origins of like Sef Ewen and that whole bit when she was like trying to like effectively lead a rebellion against it, saying, you know, we shouldn't do this. We, you know, we should try to live in peace with these people. So there's a ton of stuff going on that we don't really understand yet in terms of how this is supposed to have worked.
Yeah. And
that's the thing, is I find myself wondering if Thros is like, is Thros a pocket plane like we thought? Is it some parody of the Ardenweald where beings like, you know, get trapped and exist? Because we know that one of the things that the Drust were doing was basically tearing their spirits out of their bodies and placing them in those wood and bone constructs.
So
the wood, bone, rock constructs that they're using, that we see them using even now, like they're using in when they invade Ardenweald. So, yeah. How is this like a twisted form of their druidic magic? How does that work? Like, what's going on? That's why I think there's probably going to be a Thros something, a raid, an outdoor zone, something.
So one of the things I was actually curious about, and this goes back to the idea of them having like this massive corrupting force available to them, is I'm wondering if Thros itself became maybe not necessarily a pocket dimension, but I'm wondering if they subverted something else to their will. Like, I'm wondering if where they go or where they're coming from, their invasion point, existed beforehand as something else, maybe in the Shadowlands or maybe adjacent to something else that they took over. Because we've seen that they spread like a virus. Like, once they're there, the amount of influence that they can exert is staggering. And, like, I don't know if that was just because they happened to hit where there's an anima drought, or if it's just the nature of their magic, but it is incredibly infectious. And, like, it's just, like, going back to just the size of their army, the size of the corrupted army of the Sylvan that they have. Did they do that to another place? Did they do that to somewhere else to make it their own?
One of the things that's argued, at least in game, is that the Lost Codex did an interview with Alex Afrasiabi, and they mentioned that Thros was some kind of like offshoot of the Emerald Nightmare. I'm not sure how that works. Like, I don't, you know, this is just based on an interview. It might not be still what they're going to do.
Yeah, especially because like the idea of Thros being the Blighted Lands and mm-hmm. like if that having that moniker, if that plays into it at all.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. But if you think about it in terms of like the how the Emerald Nightmare is a twisted, you know, version of it's a deformation on the Emerald Dream, it would make sense that if you corrupt it, you could use it to get to Ardenweald.
Right. It would.
You know, and that's something to think about in terms of how their magic works and why it works on the beings in Ardenweald. You know, we know that the Shadowlands are vulnerable to attack from the Void.
Yeah, we've seen it multiple times.
And it's, in fact, one of the reasons that supposedly Maldraxxus was created, and it's one of the reasons that they have, the Kyrian have fought them. So there's, the thing is that supposedly Gorakhtul was trapped within the Blighted Lands. Like, that's like the whole bit, the whole thing that we see in Drustvar, if you play Alliance, that whole storyline involving the Drust is about Gorakhtul trying to get out of Thros because he's trapped there.
Yeah, that's why he corrupts the Waycrest family line in order to, because they're the seat of power of Drustvar.
Plus, they're the descendants of the person that, like, you know, killed him in the first place.
It's the Salem Witch Trials sort of trope thing again, which I'm fine with. I think it works.
What's really interesting is that the invasion of Thros, I mean, the invasion of Thros into Ardenweald, and their desire to use I want to say Rebirth. I can't remember the name of the Grove of Awakening. They want to use the Grove of Awakening to return themselves back to, you know, to basically free themselves from Thros. They're still stuck in Thros. And that makes me wonder if the reason you don't see Gorakhtul is because he's still stuck in Thros and can't even get out to, like, go to Ardenweald. And the ones that can go to Ardenweald are, like, you know, just the tip of the iceberg. And why is it some of them can? How are they doing it? There's still a ton of this we don't know yet. But it's interesting to me because it feels like it kind of, you've got that storyline, and you've got the Bwon Samdi storyline with Muzala, and, you know, how Muzala goes from, we find out three things. One is that Muzala, quote unquote, made Bwon Samdi what he is.
Yeah, that he raised him to a lower status.
What was he before?
Yeah.
Was he like Vol'jin? Is that, you talked before about how you thought he got all he wanted, and you didn't even mention Vol'jin when you'd said that. And I was like, because I think the Vol'jin thing is way more important than those other Loa that, you know, get into the queen's hands. That's relatively unimportant compared to the fact that Bwon Samdi has replaced Muzala completely. He has overthrown Muzala. He now has Muzala in prison. Essentially, he's using him to find out what's going on with the jailer. He's straight up exploiting his former boss. And now he's got his own kind of Loa in whatever has happened to Vol'jin.
Well, he's got himself a full ally now.
Well, no, he doesn't have an ally. They're not equals. And meanwhile, Vol'jin has the power of Razan inside him.
Yeah.
Which means now Bwon Samdi is stepping on Razan's neck. It's no more is Razan coming along and telling Bwon Samdi what to do. Now, the guy who has Razan's power is indebted to Bwon Samdi.
Well, kind of, except for two things, right? Like, in here's where I would sort of diverge from that. One, Bwon Samdi never states that he's the one that sent Vol'jin back. We still actually don't know. Like, that's not resolved yet. We still don't know what brought Vol'jin back.
Talking about him, that's not what I'm talking about in the slightest.
I understand that. Hold on, I'm getting there. But it wasn't Bwon Samdi that gave Razan's power to Vol'jin. Like,
Razan, but it doesn't matter that he's not the one who did it. He's the one that put Vol'jin in the place to do it. Because without Muzala, they would never have known to go to the Maw in the first place. I'm not saying that Vol'jin actually should owe Bwon Samdi anything. I'm saying Bwon Samdi has played it so that it looks like Vol'jin owes him. Vol'jin probably assume he owes him.
See, and that's the part that I'm not sure of, because the interactions at the end weren't this whole, yeah, I owe you one. It's, yeah, I'm beginning a whole new separate journey. Like, Vol'jin, he didn't exactly state. Now, you're right that it is definitely Bwon Samdi's way here, right? Like, that's what he does. He plays the middle position to make sure that he has the best advantage after whatever outcome happens. So if he can try to make Vol'jin feel indebted to him, absolutely right. He's going to try to. But the question is, will Vol'jin at the end of this feel indebted to him? That's the part that I'm not sure of. Now, the interesting thing is turning that on its side is this going to be a potential future problem for Bwon Samdi in that regard? Because if Vol'jin does basically take over Ferrazan in some manner, is reborn, is made Alloa, goes back to serve his people. It wasn't Bwamsamdi that saved Hyreek. It was Vol'jin, who already has a relationship with Hyreek beforehand. Remember the prophetic visions before the corruption of Gahoon to Hyreek, or at least we assume, or I assume, before the corruption of Hyreek by Gahoon, were given to Vol'jin by Hyreek. That's who he communed with during War Crimes, I want to say, or was it the Vol'jin novel? It might have been the Vol'jin. But that's who reached out to him. So is this creating another Razan problem for Bwamsamdi in the future that he's trying to avoid or trying to mitigate so that he doesn't have that same relationship? Maybe not necessarily make Vol'jin feel indebted to him, but maybe make Vol'jin feel more inclined to work with him, unlike Razan. Because remember, Razan just wouldn't do anything with Bwamsamdi. Zero. Nothing. There was no deals, no anything. Maybe this is an attempt to make him more agreeable, not feel indebted, but like, hey, we fought together, we did this together, I helped you get your friends out, you know, I made sure that your soul was safe long enough to, because like, when you're doing the stuff with Moisala, when there's a whole question, which I thought was fascinating, where you're breaking Moisala, this is after the events that happen inside of the Other Side dungeon, you go back to the ziggurat in Battle for Azeroth, you go to Nazmir. You go to Bwamsamdi's ziggurat, which I thought was interesting in and of itself, and you are taking Bwamsamdi's followers to protect them, his priests, which he didn't have before, now he does, protecting them while you break down Moisala to do the torturing. And one of the last thing that's brought in is Vol'jin as sort of this, hey, you wanted to know what happened to you, here's my friend Vol'jin. And he keeps referring to him throughout all the interactions as friend, 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 not my tool, not my, you know, bargaining partner.
That's, I'm sorry, but that's always been the way Bwamsamdi presents everything as a nice, fair deal between equals. He always does that. You're basically describing, the entire process you're describing is a way to get people to think they're indebted to you without saying, oh, you owe me one. You never say it. You never tell people that they owe you one unless you absolutely have to. The entire reason that you go to the Other Side dungeon is because he's tried his usual approach and nobody's biting. So he has to have you go in and forcibly remind them, oh no, this was a deal. You're going to pay it back now. Because that's not his style. He doesn't do that.
Fair.
It doesn't mean that he isn't manipulating Vol'jin. It just means he's manipulating Vol'jin extremely well.
Totally fair. 100% fair.
And I think the whole deal with Moisala, when you watch the Moisala bit, he even like has, you have to shield the Bwamsamdi's priests because Moisala is killing them.
He's trying to take their animal, yeah.
Yeah, he's killing them. He's straight up killing them, and you have to protect them to prevent him from doing so, which is how you break him down. There's a lot to this. Like, I keep looking at the elements we've got in play here. We've got the Tyrande bit in Torghast, and the possible discovery of a way to save her, but we don't have her at the end to make use of it.
Yeah, I was actually going to comment on that. Like, of the three major storylines, the Loa one, the Bwamsamdi one, seems to be the only one that's buttoned up tight, or at least close enough. The other two,
no, I disagree. That is not even close to buttoned up tight
compared to the other two.
Yeah, here's the thing. Sure, Moisala is dealt with. But you just got done pointing out that we don't know how Vol'jin got back in the first place. What's going on with the Loa? What is the current state of the Loa? And for that matter, all the Wild Gods.
Yeah, because now we know that there's a possibility of reconstruction to a certain point. At least I think there is, that we might wind up exploring in the future. I don't know if that'll work or how that'll work. But I think that's going to be a topic that's probably going to be brought up as we start rescuing more things from the Maw. Especially now that we know that we can rip Loa out of there. And the Razan thing is particularly fascinating to me, not in just context of the Maw, but in context back to just Ardenwell as a whole and back to Ursoc. Because Ursoc's anima, we don't know if it's been fully consumed. We know that it was being used as fuel, but so was Razan. Could Ursoc be tied back to another entity and given a chance at rebirth like Vol'jin and Razan? Is there a way that we might be able to repair some of that? I think that's what I've been thinking about since rescuing Razan is, could we fix some of the other Wild Gods? Could we fix some of these other ancient spirits in some capacity? Maybe not in their original form, but maybe... Yeah. you know,
I don't
what
think
I mean?
Ursoc is going to come back straight up. I think Ursoc's,
which is possible, but I'm throwing it out there as a thing.
No, I think it weakens their entire establishment of the zone too much if what happened to Ursoc isn't a permanent sacrifice. And for that matter, the main point of view character of that cinematic also dies. So that's interesting to me that Aralon does not make it through this campaign.
No, he
doesn't. Told you guys there are spoilers, so if you're a big Aralon fan, you're like, oh my god, what? Yeah, Aralon dies too.
We kill him, technically.
We kill him because the Drust disguise him as Gorak Zar, and we kill Gorak Zar, and it turns out to be Aralon the whole time. And really, considering that one of the Night Fae is the one who detects this, they probably should have detected it a little earlier, guys. Next time, let me know before I'm bashing the guy's head against the
Listen,
ground.
It's just classic Moonberry. I find it fascinating the way that those things are going. But I think maybe we should take the last 10-15 minutes of the podcast here to talk about what happens with the Night Elf side of things.
One of the things that happens is while doing all of this, you find out that there were Night Warriors before. You find I keep wanting to say the ghost because I don't know what else to call it, the spirit of a previous Night Warrior and his husband, mate. I don't remember the names off the top of my head, which is dumb because I should. I was just doing this, but regardless, the two of them are living out in Ardenweald. They've chosen a life there.
Yeah, they're stags, right?
Yeah, well, no, one of them's a unicorn.
One's a unicorn, that's right.
One of them's a unicorn, one of them's a stag.
What is it, Theranax and Katarin?
I think so. I mean, like I said, I don't remember their names. That's, you know, Theranax and Kadarin. Yeah, Theranax and Kadarin.
Yep.
I believe Kadarin is the stag and Theranax is the unicorn.
Yep.
But regardless, you find out that there's, Theranax became the Night Warrior on his planet to stop an old god and succeeded, but the power tore him apart. And when they found out that that was happening, Kadarin attempted to siphon some of the Night Warrior curse off of him and onto himself, thus sharing the power out, and that way neither of them would be torn apart. However, that wasn't sufficiently split, and they were instead both torn apart.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just one of them dying, they both died. Which Theranax blamed himself and didn't want to talk about the Night Warrior anymore after that. But eventually you figure it out. Theranax is Kadarin is cursed by one of the I don't know if they're working for the Drust or if they're working for Mazala, the little Spriggan guys. I don't know which evil force they're working for. But regardless, they're working for somebody. And they put a curse on him, so you have to help him, you know, decurse his husband. And when you do that, he finally reveals this is the secret of the Night Warrior, that we tried to do this and it might have worked, but it wasn't split him off enough people. And that's part of the reason it feels like the storyline is heading towards that's the reason why we're getting all these Night Elf souls out of Torghast. I mean, obviously we're getting them out of Torghast because they shouldn't be there.
Yeah, it's the right thing to do one way or another.
But it also feels like, to a certain degree, the ultimate aim is possibly to spread the Night Warrior out among a couple hundred or a couple thousand spirits, rather than just have it be two.
Yeah, I've been wondering about that, though, because, like, can it be done with the spirits, or does it need to be living beings? Because Taran's not dead. Not yet. And that's something that Kadarin and Theranax tried to do while they were still alive. So I've been wondering if this is going to be one of those things where we get a whole new breed of Night Elf. Like, is this going to be a thing where we figure out how to do it and maybe spread the curse out among the living so that we just now have more powerful, more Night Elves that are capable of handling themselves even more so than they already were?
Maybe a completely different, just a different, now they'd be like the Vengeance Elves or something, I don't know. Much like the Blood Elves and the High Elves are basically the same. There's slight differences, but they weren't, you know, it could be similar to that where you now have, you know, something else. I don't know what you'd call them. Ironically, I always think it's weird that the name of the Nightborn actually is, you know, Children of the Night or Children of the Shadow, I think, or something. Whereas the name of the Night Elves, actually the Kaldari, means Children of the Stars. Not Children of the Night. I mean, obviously stars come out at night, but nevertheless, you could more accurately call them Star Elves, and it would be closer to what their name actually means.
Sure.
I don't know if they're going to possibly you know, now that the Night Warrior thing, if the Night Warrior thing was spread out to all living Night Elves, would they now truly be the Night Elves? You know, it's just one of those things I think about. It wouldn't necessarily need to, like, do anything. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, if ever, you know, I've got the Night Warrior cosmetic option is one of the options that you can have now, but there are so many cool options that I don't use it anymore.
So, and that was one of the things that got me going down this path, too, is, like, I know that it's an art asset, but we've seen in the past that not every art asset is without some form of later purpose. And it seemed like giving you the ability to become the Night Warrior, at least in terms of your eyes, taking on that inky darkness that Tyrande has, it seemed a little bit weird. Like, it was cool, don't get me wrong, but it didn't make sense story-wise. There's only one Night Warrior, right? Well, until we got to this point, we started realizing that there could potentially be multiple. And that's when I started thinking, like, maybe that's going to be a hook that we explore, which is spreading out that power among all of the Night Elves that are still in existence, who no longer have a home, who are, you know, trying to find some way to get back on their feet. They're in an area where we talked about they basically have moved to Hyjal at this point, right? Where they have the high ground, they have an open door to the elemental plane of fire still in their backyard, they have everything else that's been happening, plus they seem to be pulling a little bit away from the Alliance. Could we see the Night Elves, you know, embrace this power and become more of a voice that has to be listened to because they have this power now? Is this something that was sort of like spoiled through that new customization instead of you know, just being a neat cosmetic thing? So I've been thinking about that a lot. Like, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I think it would be kind of okay, but I'm guessing my question to you is, like, if that's something that would happen, how would you feel about it? You're very tied to Night Elves, I feel. So I feel like your opinion here matters a lot.
I don't know, because I don't know how they're going to do it. I mean, that's one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is, would they literally just say that every Night Elf has to take part in it, and now from now on, we're all like that? I don't want them to do that. Like, I don't feel like I don't want that choice taken away from my character. I could see that, definitely could see them establishing that, like, you know, a sect of Night Elves became like Night Warriors permanently. And that's like, you know, the Sentinels and the Wardens. Now we'd have Night Warriors as a sect of Night Elves that you need to basically take part in the ritual and absorb part of that power into yourself to be a part of. And that would be great. I just don't like the idea of every single Night Elf is now a black guy. You know, we just got the cosmetic options. And plus, as a story thing, I feel like not every Night Elf should be consumed by vengeance.
Yeah, and maybe it becomes a choice thing, right? Like, maybe that's the story.
The idea of a new group of Night Elves who are now dedicated to vengeance and who are, you know, possibly permanently unforgiving. Like, they're never going to they will be a roadblock to peace going forward for the rest of, you know, time, because they live for thousands of years and they're never going to stop hating the Horde ever. They'll never stop. Then nothing the Horde can do can make up for it. If they got their hands on Thrall, they would execute him.
Yeah.
And they're never going to forgive. That would be an interesting case of consequences for the Horde's continuous warmongering. Like, so far in WoW's story, not in Warcraft's story, but in WoW's story, the Horde keeps going on, like, violence benders. Like, they just, you know, every so often a new Warchief comes along and they just go nuts and start, you know, they did it with Garrosh, they did it with Sylvanas. And it's, you know, this was even commented on by, of all people, Sarfang. Like, you know, this keeps happening. They keep repeating the same mistakes. And there's never any real consequences to the Horde for it. It's always everybody else who pays the price. The Horde never does.
Mm-hmm.
The Horde absolutely didn't pay the price for blowing up Theramore.
Nope.
There was no consequences to the Horde for that. The Horde, you know, sure, okay, the invasion of Orgrimmar, which ended with the Horde fully in control of Orgrimmar and Vol'jin on the throne. It's like, okay, Garrosh paid a price, but, you know, the Horde didn't, as an organization, didn't lose anything. Then you look at the beginning of Battle for Azeroth. The Horde marches its way right through all of the Night Elf lands, burns Tel'Drassil, and loses nothing. They get pushed out of Tel'Drassil. They get pushed out of Darkshore. That's the big consequence to the Horde. They don't get to hold on to the stuff they took. That's not a consequence thematically. If ultimately this ended up in a situation where the Night Elves were a permanently implacable opponent to the Horde, it would make narrative sense. And if the Night Warrior is the way you do it, like, and then maybe the you've got a storyline where the Alliance has to deal with the fact that these guys are just straight up never going to go along.
Yeah.
And so how are we going to have peace if these people won't go along? Like, they won't. They will not accept. The closest they'll get to accepting is, we won't attack them right now. Like, all right, we won't attack them right now. We are not taking attacking them in the future off the menu. That'll never happen. And that would be interesting from an Alliance standpoint. And it would also be interesting from a Horde standpoint, because then the Horde have to decide who they want to be, whether or not the other side likes them.
Yeah.
You know, and there's good story in that. The idea that the Horde just decides, it doesn't matter if they ever forgive us. We have to decide who we want to be. We have to decide what we want to do. And do you try to make amends anyway, even though the person you injured is absolutely not interested in hearing from you? Like, there's stuff to be done with it. I don't want to see, like, all Night Elves are now the Night Warrior. That would not be something I'd like. But I would like something along the lines of a couple thousand of the Night Elves decide to join this new group and become Night Warriors. And now you've got these Night Warriors who are protecting Night Elf territory, and they're protecting it. Seriously.
See, and I think it's an interesting potential evolution for them as well, because you've had wardens and sentinels for so long, but all of these traditional lands, all of this traditional structure that the Night Elves have had for, you know, however long at this point, is gone now. And maybe you don't need wardens anymore. Maybe you actually don't need sentinels anymore. Maybe instead you need night warriors now. And that sort of evolves. Like, I could see, like, the more militaristic, more protective minded night elves stepping up and saying, I will take on this burden so that I can continue to protect my people and continue to right wrongs done against us. 100%, I would be on board with that. I think you're right. I think it would be good story. I think it would be a fascinating story for both sides as a result of it. Internal strife with the Alliance and internal reckoning within the Alliance. Because don't forget, like, they also have to contend with the fact that the Alliance sort of abandoned them for a good chunk of time, because there were other more important things, and I'm making air quotes with my fingers here, to deal with. The Horde has to pay for what it does. And I'm saying this as a Horde player. The Horde's done some really awful, awful things. There needs to be a reckoning. And, like, you're right, there has to be some form of...
I'm not even saying, like, the Horde has to be punished. I'm saying that narratively there need to be consequences.
Yeah.
Consequences doesn't mean, you know, someone comes along and smacks you for being bad.
Exactly.
This thing happened, and therefore, since this thing happened and it was consequential, that means that things that follow from it happen.
Things have to change, right? Like, and I think it would give, like you said,
The story has to reflect what we've seen. If Tyrande does become, like, some kind of, you know, messianic figure sharing the power of the Night Warrior with her people, and you create this new group within the Night Elves who are Night Warriors, there's a storyline consequence to this. That you know, you talked about some people would step up and say, I will take on this burden to keep protecting my people. But what about the people who just want to protect their people? Mm-hmm. They don't want to be part of this militant order. They're not vengeful. They just want to protect their people. They don't have a place in this new order. Do they accept that their time is done?
But I think
do they push against it? Do you get story out of that?
And I think you get some story out of that, though, too, because I think, like, there's already been some form of some of that established with the history of, like, the Sentinels versus the Wardens, right? Like, and sort of, like, the roles that they filled. And there's nothing that says that they have to, and like you said, like, finding that balance point, I think, would be very, very interesting. Like, is it two opposing forces grading against each other internally, or is it, yes, they'll go do that thing, we'll focus on this, and we'll keep doing this thing? Like,
there's also, though, keep in mind, though, we're talking about this, but one of the things we're seeing from the campaign is that there's a lot of interconnection between forces that don't normally seem interconnected. I mean, whether it's Wild Gods or Loa or Ancient Guardians or whatever, they're all going through Ardenweald.
Yeah.
The Drust are attacking Ardenweald. And so, in a way, I mean, we didn't really talk about any of the other campaigns, and we probably won't get to do much. I just do want to mention, though, that I've seen the end of the Kyrian campaign. And the Kyrian campaign is also in its own way diverse and has a lot of stuff going on. There's too much to cover in the like 4 minutes or so we've got. Probably a little bit more because we interrupted twice for meeting bad. But there's this idea of these forces are interconnected in ways that we don't see when we're alive because their interconnections are on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, in some cases, the other side. But the idea of like the Kyrian being under attack by the Forsworn and even a lot of the Forsworn not knowing that the Mossworn are involved, that mm-hmm. that they effectively that the jailer is working with various higher ups in the Forsworn. Some of the Mossworn are not necessarily the Forsworn, and they don't like Uther didn't know. Uther had no idea that they were drawing on the power of the Maw. He's like, that's the power that got us into this mess in the first place. Why would you work with it?
Yeah, that's the power that, you know, ripped part of my soul out. Why would I want to be involved with that? That was the whole reason that I was angsty to begin with. Yeah.
He turns on Lysonia as soon as he finds out. There's also the fact that for all, like in both of those campaigns, only the two I've seen, in the end, the higher up figure, the Winter Queen or the Archon, are both involved in the story. But in the Ardenweald one, the Winter Queen is definitely, it's like she's much more of an active force. You get the sense that the Archon is never really imperiled. Even when the end of the whole thing is that Lysonia and her followers have managed to clear the path and they're attacking the Archon directly, and they're going to destroy her. And literally, while you're fighting Lysonia, the Archon is taking out every single one of her followers. It doesn't even look like she's breaking a sweat. She doesn't. At no point do you get the sense that the Archon is in any real danger. And you definitely get the sense that the Archon, at any point, if Lysonia had stopped, the Archon would have been fine, would have just taken her back. And that, to me, is fascinating. I want to know more about the Archon and the Archon's history and Bastion as a group. That's why I honestly feel like we've gotten the first raid of the expansion was Castle Nathria, which really explains Revendreth. And we'll do a show about Revendreth soon.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot to talk about there, but we don't have that for any, you know, we've got two dungeons in Bastion and they don't explain much about Bastion.
No, we have the Spires of Ascension, which, you know, that doesn't really explain anything because it's under assault, and you have Necrotic Wake, which is Necrotic Wake.
Yeah. It's both of them are, you know, they're like, if you want to know more about Devos, Spires of Ascension does give you that at least, but there's a lot that I feel like it would not surprise me if every single zone gets a raid.
And I'd be okay with that, or at least like some advancement of the story, because it's sort of to
we just finished the campaign for this patch. You know there's going to be more.
And that's sort of how I want to finish things out here, is that like for every, and not that I had any problem with like the Night Fae Covenant campaign, I thought it was very well done. I liked the story beats to it. I just felt that it was incomplete, and not in a bad way. It's just that there's more story to tell because there's more expansion to tell.
It reminded me of Legion, when you first get to the end of the first patch with that storyline.
Yeah, and sort of how the Order Hall campaign took time to advance about that as well, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it feels a lot like that, and that's not a bad thing. We've compared the Covenant campaigns to the Order Hall campaigns as a good thing. Some Order Hall campaigns were better than others just because there were so dang many storylines to follow. But with the Covenants only having four Covenants, they can focus their efforts more, right? And so I think we're going to see more. I think there's going to be more story to tell. And I think that, like, it'll evolve. Like, when you get your achievement, it is, like, you know, Night Fae campaign, Covenant campaign complete. Or, you know, Kyrian Covenant campaign complete. I think that's going to change. I think it's going to be Covenant Campaign Part 2 or Covenant Campaign Part 3 as the expansion moves forward and more content is released. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. We'll see, but that definitely does feel like something they're going to be. And I'm definitely looking forward to it because I want to see what actually happens in these zones. I want to see their story unfold to a degree.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So if you have some thoughts about how the campaigns unfolded, if you've played through them, let us know. I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on it, as long as they're constructive. Don't be mean. But yeah, let us know. And we didn't get to any questions this week. And that's perfectly fine. If you do have questions for the show, though, please feel free to send them in to us. We will look at them. You can send them to one of our Discord channels. We do have one set aside specifically for patrons. We do have one for non-patrons for just basically Q questions. We will look there for podcast questions as well. If Discord isn't your thing, you can go ahead and send them to us via email at podcast@blizzardwatch.com. We will fight over ones that are ambiguous, but just let us know which show it's for. And then we'll talk about the other Covenant campaigns. We'll probably do a series of these. So probably the next several weeks will be us talking about these campaigns. So hopefully that's something you'll be interested in and join us and give us your opinions on your experience with the Covenant campaigns. But Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And with that, folks, thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
Kayla Itzinis. I'm Kayla Itzinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.